Tommy, Tom Esker. And to communicate with Terrible Tommy, you just send your letters or cards or whatever you want to send, boxes full of money, to Tom Metzger, P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, that's S-A-N-J-A-C-I-N-T-O, California, zip 92583, we'll get it. And subscribe to our radio show, too. Do it today. Well, boys and girls, it's Wotan's Day. David Lane, a martyr, David Lane's favorite day. And it is the 13th of December. We're headed on down to Santa Claus Day. I've got my Bah Humbug hat out. I wear it all over the place. And the senior codgers today are having a Christmas party. I get to go there with my Bah Humbug hat on. I'm going to reach into the mailbag today. We've got several letters here. I'm going to read you a few and let you know what's happening with the brothers behind the wire. Dennis Mahon got a letter from the Southern Poverty Law Center. They want to talk to him. He sent me a copy. How did you feel about being named as a possible co-conspirator in the Oklahoma City bombing? Well, I'm sure he felt just wonderful. I know you denied any involvement, duh, and were never charged, duh. How often do you hear from family, friends, and supporters? My contact information is below. Thank you for taking the time to read this letter, and I hope you will respond to me, because you know all of us folks here at the Southern Poverty Law Center are 100% on your side. I added that just for fun. Oh, this was a two-part letter, and this is the rest of it. Mr. Mahon, I hope this finds you well as possible. My name is Brett Barakwir. Interesting end of the name there. And I am an investigative reporter with the publication arm of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We're in business to help prisoners. No, he didn't say that. Before my current position, I spent nearly two decades writing about inmates. their issues, prison conditions, and other issues related to incarceration, death row, and how inmates are treated. I'm sure you're really interested in that. You may have been before, but now you're with Morris Dees. He's mostly interested in making the money, man. Or getting somebody to rat on their buddies. Attached are several of those stories so you can see how I am handling issues and the inmates I've dealt with. I'm curious how you are treated in prison, given the high-profile nature of your case. Yeah, as I understand it, it was like an M80 in a package. I mean, that's nasty, but it's certainly nothing like goes on most of the time. By the other side, like the guy that just had a pipe bomb explode in his pants. That's instant justice. Do you get the medical care you need? Of course not. No prisoner does. How are you treated by the staff? Shitty, like all prisoners. Other inmates? He gets along. How do you stay occupied on a day-to-day basis in prison? What's a typical day for you? What is your outlook? How are you treated in prison, given your views you have expressed in public? Do they cause you any issues, or other inmates, or the prison staff? If so, what kinds of issues? I'm sure you are leery of someone from the SBLC writing you. No shit, Sherlock. But before joining the organization this week, and you got a lot to learn, boy, I spent years as a news reporter. I'm only out to give you a fair shake and an accurate report on what you say. Well, if you were to do that, you'd be fired immediately. I'm also curious of how your views developed. How did you become aligned many years ago with David Duke? I am acquainted with Mr. Duke from my days living in Louisiana. I've met him a few times, and I find him charming and quite nice. You know, that's a word they use a lot over the years with Duke. He's charming. He's charming. That's sort of like effeminate to me. Why did you split with him? And what do you think of the political ambitions of Mr. Duke and others? Write me back right away, sweetie pie, and I'll send you a file and a cake. Yeah. Dear Tom, thank you for the letter you sent me last week. I am being transferred out of this hellhole, probably around December the 15th or so. I have been in the SHU for 54 days now for some kind of secret investigation. They won't tell me what it is, but I'm glad after 2 years here I am leaving. They won't even let me have a small pen to write with in here. Just these dull flex pens. Pencils. The guards won't even sharpen them or replace them when they get dull. We're only allowed to use the phone once a month. The prison here are afraid of the mestizos, blacks, and treat the child pornographers, molesters, with kid gloves. It seems the Fed government will always persecute me as an enemy of the state. Well, that's a compliment, Dennis. You are an enemy of the state. We're all enemies of the state if we're doing any good. I agree that the deep state has Trump on the tight leash. I think this whole crazy Zog-Rog nation is on the verge of total chaos and balkanization. I hope it is. We may have a readout in the upper Midwest, Pacific Northwest area, or maybe in Appalachia Mountain area. Well, my 28 U.S.C. 2255 motion is progressing good. I still have some hope yet. Thanks for not forgetting me. your loyal friend, Dennis Mahon. Hail Bob Matthews. So his spirits are high. Be interesting to know what kind of a bullshit investigation they're pulling on him, because he's obviously not involved in anything. You never know what they're trying to do in the background, so keep your guard up. 14 words, I have nothing to say. And if you do have something to say, simply say, I have nothing to say. Nothing drives an agent, FBI, or even a local cop crazier than when you say, I have nothing to say. Get me a lawyer and stick to it. That drives them up the wall. They can be Mr. Nice Guy, good guy, bad guy, good guy, until you say that, and then they turn into bad guy immediately. This investigation may simply have to do with Dennis putting in a complaint to the powers that be about the conditions, certain conditions in the prison. And of course, that's a no-no. You can't criticize the operation of a prison. So he got a letter back from the office of the regional director. Dear Mr. Mahon, this is in response to an inquiry you made wherein you expressed concerns regarding the safety, health, and security of inmates at the Federal Correctional Institution, Hazleton, FCI, as it relates to commissary operations. You also expressed concerns about the current shopping schedule. You state there is limited air ventilation system in the commissary waiting area, and the rated capacity is often exceeded, causing overcrowded conditions. Our review of this matter reveals the administration of FCI Hazleton worked diligently with commissary staff and correctional service staff to develop a daily movement and shopping schedule that accommodates the inmate population and contributes to the safe and orderly running of the institution. Commissary operations are designed to enhance an inmate's conditions of confinement and serves as a privilege to the inmate population. Well, that's a bunch of bullshit. The shopping schedule is designed to allow all inmates equal opportunity to shop on a weekly basis. In addition, the current air ventilation system was installed during the construction of the facility and has been tested to ensure airflow is sufficient, and the system is working as designed. The rated capacity of the commissary waiting area is 60. Staff at FCI Hazleton have designed the movement schedule to ensure inmates can shop safely and the capacity is maintained at a suitable level. Controlled movements allow inmates to shop and return their housing units. I trust this addresses your problem. In answer to that, Mahon says 97 inmates in an 18-foot by 22-foot locked room for 1.5 to 2 hours. No airflow out the small air vents. So you see, they talk about democracy. You get no real rights in a prison. You might as well forget it. If they want to screw you, they're going to screw you. If they want to beat you, they're going to beat you. If they want to kill you, they're going to kill you. You're inside a total police state. That's why you do your best to stay out of them. I remember when I was in L.A. County Jail for 45 days, they used to have two great big burly deputies accompany me to the shower. I mean, just to make sure I didn't get killed. Not because they gave a shit whether I got killed, but it would be bad on their blotter. The news media might ask a few questions. Because Ira Reiner was the DA that set up all that stuff. Ira Reiner, the Jew, the darling of the Jewish Defense League and the ADL. I'm going to have to check the historical records and see whatever happened to Ira Reiner. He may be dead, I don't know, but I haven't heard anything about him actually since I got out of jail. And here's another nice card from a prisoner of war. Tom, I wish you and your family a very joyous Yule. May the new year bring us all one step closer to a brighter and whiter world. 14 words, Richard Scutari. Did you ever receive the third visiting form? I was sent visiting forms, a total of 3, which I filled out every one of them and sent back in to get in to see Richard Scutari. And none of them worked. But the last time here, I made it to signature mail, first class signature mail. So the guy that's supposed to get it has to sign for it. We'll see what happens. I got a nice letter here from Dan Christian from down in Plano, Texas. The name is familiar, but I don't remember how I knew him. It's been quite a while. Hi, Tommy. Checked out your website. I was curious and had not been there in quite a while. It looks great. I noticed you had moved back to California, guess to be with your children. I hope it was a positive move for you and your wife and children are doing well. My purpose for writing you was to say hello and give you the notice of Ernst and Ingrid Zundel. Both have passed on. First, Ernest died on August the 5th, and followed by Ingrid on October 12th. I had traveled to Tennessee to meet Ingrid a couple of years ago, and we became fast friends. I will miss her. Yes, I'm still going down the rabbit hole. A friend's legal travails with the system. Aroused my curiosity on legal questions. I've been had my head buried in the quagmire of Judaic lies and mischief for a couple of years. The dishonesty and foul dealing by judges, prosecutors, and cops can cast a stifling black shadow on anyone's heart. There is a whole world of legal beagles battling the system of corrupt courts and judges. I am naive, but I have some faith that there is a chance the 100th monkey theory of knowing kicks in and suddenly everyone will be aware of and understand the government scam that has enslaved us all. Well, Dan, I think you're right there, but the problem is the easy part is hard, knowing. The hard part is action, no matter what it takes. And that's where you run into a big stone wall. You may have pondered the idea that the masses don't have enough IQ to keep pace with the Jews who have dreamed up this system of slavery. That idea occurred to me last night while studying birth certificates and citizenship issues. You need an IQ of 110 or better just to get started. America's average IQ is 100. So there may be an intellectual abyss too large to breach. Yeah, I've been thinking that too. I will occasionally check back with the website and listen to the radio show. I've always appreciated your humor and folksy way of telling stories and drawing out the important events. I am including your Christmas present, a coupon accepted everywhere. Sincerely, Dan. Yeah, he sent along a green stamp. I'll share part of it with the POWs. And I'll have to send him out the radio show. I don't know whether I told you, but I was searching out the address of federal prisoner for Dennis Mahon because I thought somebody had emailed me and said they'd transferred him already. So I brought it up, but this is a real joke. Came up a black guy, 44 years old, in federal prison. But his name wasn't Dennis Mahon, but I about fell off my chair. That's funny. You feed the prisoner number in and you get one number off, you don't know who you're going to get. Well, somebody's got a record of that research. They're going to say, what the hell is Metzger communicating with a black 44-year-old federal prisoner? Well, he's in our black division. Remember the book Camp of the Saints in the end when they're all fighting it out like the Alamo, and the black guy yells over to the white guys? Some people may not believe it, but there's a lot of Japanese that have a lot of things in common with us. And as I told you before, back in the 80s I was there and was initiated into the ceremonies of the Shinto temple in downtown Tokyo. Met a lot of good Asian, Japanese, racist, National Socialists. And the National Socialists in Japan don't try to pretend they're white. They know what they are, and they're proud of it. They sent me this the other day. Nikkan Keigi Japan Conference is a Japanese Nationalist Unincorporated Association and state Shinto advocating religious organization that was established in 1997 and was approximately 38,000 members. Their group is influential in legislative and executive branches of the Japanese government through its affiliates Shinzo Abe. And I knew the Shinzo Abe situation. The Prime Minister of Japan serves as a special advisor to the group's parliamentary league. The group describes its aims as to change the post-war national consciousness based on the Tokyo Tribunal's view of history as a fundamental problem, and to revise the current constitution and to see its mission to promote patriotic education and the revision of the Constitution of Japan, and support for official visits to Yakuzo Shrine, which they took me to there in Japan. It's a 2,000-year-old shrine down in the island chain. In the words of Hideki Kasi, an influential member of the Nippon Kigi, we are dedicated to our conservative cause. We are monarchists. We are for reviving the Constitution. We are for the glory of the nation. Nippon Keigi supports revising the Japanese Constitution, especially Article 9, which forbids a standing army. Yeah, you got to have a standing army, boys. That's what I told you when you were over there. And when I spoke to them 500 strong, I said, you know, don't trust Washington. Never trust Washington. I think that got me in a lot of trouble with a lot of people, too. Nippon Keigi has described six official goals of the organization as 1. A beautiful traditional sovereignty for Japan's future, fostering a sense of Japanese unity and social stability based around the imperial household, shared history and culture, the traditions of the Japanese people. Sounds pretty good so far, huh? I wish we had government people doing that. 2. A new constitution appropriate for the new era, restoring national defense rights, rectifying the unbalanced rights and obligations, strengthen the emphasis of the family system, and loosening the separation of religion and state. 3. Politics that protect the state's reputation and the people's lives, addressing the loss of public interest in politics and government by taking more aggressive stance in historical debates and crisis management, creating education that fosters a sense of Japanese unity. And when they say Japanese unity, they mean racial unity. Addressing various problems arising in the Japanese educational system, bullying, prostitution, and so on, and instituting respect for the national flag and anthem, respect for national history, culture, and traditions, in the process of abandoning gender-free education and critical views of Japanese history, contributing to world peace by strengthening national security, strengthening Japanese defense power in order to counterbalance China, North Korea, and other hostile powers, and remember Japanese war dead. Friendship with the world, tied together by a spirit of coexistence and mutual prosperity, building friendly relations with foreign countries through social and cultural exchange programs. Some have claimed that Nippon Kagi believes that Japan should be applauded for liberating much of East Asia from the Western colonial powers, that in 46 and 48 Tokyo War Crimes tribunals were illegitimate, and that the killings of Imperial Japanese troops during 1937 Nanjing Massacre was exaggerated or fabricated. The group vigorously defends Japanese claim to its territorial dispute over the Senkaku Islands with China, and denies that Japan forced the Comfort women into sexual slavery during World War II. Nippon Kagi fights against feminism, LGB rights, and the 1999 gender equality law. Nippon Kagi was founded in 1997 through the merger of two groups whose agendas include constitutional revisionism. Nihon Wo Mamorai Kokuman Kagi, National Conference to Defend Japan and People's Conference, Protect Japan, founded in 1981, included many veterans of the Japanese Imperial Army and Navy, and published its own constitutional reform draft in 1994. Its predecessors was Gengo Hosokai Jisuchai, National Conference to Implement Regional Year Legislation, founded in 1978, that comprised several Shinto and religious cults. Remember, Shintoism is the military-oriented, very close to the Odinist Viking belief. The founding of the president was Koichi Tsukakamoto, the founder of the Japanese clothier Wakoko. Yuzo Kobashime, the secretary-treasurer of the Nippon Kagi, established a sister organization, Nihon Seinan Kaigai, in 1977, which is headquarters in the same building as Nippon Kagi. The acts of the organization's secretariat. Nippon Kagi claims 35,000 individual members, 47 prefectural chapters, and about 230 local chapters. The organization's website lists the members depending on their seniority in an organization headed by a president, seconded by vice president, and pool of advisors. Actually, eminent Shinto priests leading key shrines, some of them belonging to the imperial family. Some of these people I met while I was in Japan twice. Among the regional branches, Nippon Kagi Hiroshima, Japanese Congress Hiroshima, consists of about 750 Hiroshima residents. Its executive director, Asatadi, is the son of an A-bomb victim. I visited both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What a sad thing that was. Harry Truman was a horrible war criminal as far as I'm concerned. And a lot of you people who are still Catholics out there, remember, they used the spiral or the peak of the building of the biggest Catholic church in Tokyo as the ground zero to drop that bomb. It was a landmark set high above the city, and so they used that. That's sort of symbolic of the Judaism-type execution. Following the 2014 reshuffle of the third Abe cabinet, 15 of the 18 members, including Prime Minister himself, were members of the Nippon Kagi. most of them 63% of the extended 97-member Kabe administration, and nearly 80% or 90% of its 18 cabinet ministers also belong to the Shinto Association of Spiritual Leadership Diet Members Caucus Advocating State Shinto. Remember, the only reason they wanted to push Japanese into an attack on Pearl Harbor was to get us into war with Japan so Roosevelt could declare war on Hitler. That was the main reason for that. But if you'd read all the reasons and situations that pushed Japan into the situation where she had no other alternative than to strike back, you'll know why most of World War II was a terrible situation. Absolutely unneeded. Didn't have to happen. 55 million white people died, and just think, probably at least that many Asians died, and Japanese. I mean, we've been led by war criminals and warmongers for so long you can't remember. And they dish it up to these dumb white and non-white people as great crusades to save Western humanity. Well, they're doing the best they can to destroy Western humanity. And like I said before, even on these two trips to Japan where I visited all the important places and met with a lot of important people, including people of the government, and had personal conversations and spoke to 500 at a time, not one bit of that turned up in the U.S. news. Not one bit. CNN was right there. Everybody was right there. That just shows you they don't want any kind of a real peaceful talk among people who really want peace. And like I said before, right at the time I went over there, the first time, was the time that North Korea sent their first rocket across the sea there, right over Japan. And I told them when I spoke to them, I said, you better prepare, and prepare for your own defense. Don't depend on the United States for anything. I think some of my words got through. I really do believe it. And the reason they were interested in me, because I was just a common working class white person who loved his race. They tended to be more interested in what I had to say than the politicians. As I have told you many times before, which gets me in trouble with some people, Germany had everything to gain by keeping the pact with the Soviet Union back in the late 30s. 50,000 German engineers a year were going into Russia and rebuilding the infrastructure. And that was even after Stalin was in control. Hundreds of millions of Deutschmarks were being invested in the Soviet Union rebuilding the infrastructure. And that was right next to the time the war began, the attack began, not too long before, or too long after, or whatever. This is where I believe Hitler went off the rails. Germany was doing fine by negotiations and diplomacy. There was no need whatsoever, and the old canard that the Soviet Union was poised to attack Germany is a total lie. Never happened. I told you before, Stalin, his idea was to borrow from within, through cleverness and sort of the Jewish way, to degrade countries and take them over without a big fight. And Germany was moving towards the peak of its power, and Stalin was not that kind of guy to walk into all of those cannons and tanks. So the bullshit that the right wing fed me when I was younger is just a lot of bullshit. And that's why I say that to understand anything about this deal, you got to read this book, A History of Soviet Russia by George von Rausch. Now, if you ask any right-winger, any fanatic anti-communist, he's going to say, oh my God, that guy's a total rat, he's this, he's that. I don't think so. So I'm going to read you a little bit here. And this was on the eve of the war. Preventive war or surprise attack. Germany did not respond to these gestures, and Moscow's resulting uneasiness became more pronounced when the news of Rudolf Hess's flight to England became known. Now, that flight, you should know as well as I do, he was on a diplomatic mission. It's bullshit that Hitler didn't know what he was doing or didn't tell him to go. Hitler had a fetish with the Empire of Britain. He wanted to ally with Britain and then rush, move towards the east and do what they did on the attack against Russia and wipe them out. And the Russians knew that. Stalin was no idiot. It was believed that as Hitler's personal emissary, he had been ordered to arrange an alliance between Germany and Great Britain against the Soviet Union. In consequence, several things occurred which could be taken as harbingers of the coming war. Air raid drills were intensified, foreign diplomats were restricted in their movements, foreigners were refused travel permits, Pravda repeatedly reminded the people of their patriotic duties, there were troop reinforcements. You know, Stalin knew he was in real trouble if there was an attack because the people were really not that patriotic. It took the war, just like a war here, to get the people together to get behind the government. And he knew that. There were troop reinforcements, noticeably on the Western Front. Now, the right wing will tell you, oh, yeah, they were getting ready to attack Germany. No, they were doing what any country would do. They put troops on the Western frontier just in case, especially in the neighborhood of Lvov. In the last days of April, Count Schellenberg returned to Berlin, taking with him a Russian offer to deliver 5 million metric tons of grain to Germany in 1942. He strongly advocated the maintenance of peace between Germany and Russia and attempted to convince Hitler that the Russian troop concentrations along the border were prompted by the Russian desire for security, and that Stalin was prepared to further cooperation with Germany for the further economic concessions. It was in vain. Hitler had already made his decision, which actually it sounded to me like in opposition to much of his own people, much of his own party, but they couldn't say anything or off with their head. Throughout April, there had been an increasing number of protest notes because of the border violations, mainly by airplanes. Both sides were trying to explore the strength of the foe. 150 German divisions stood on Russia's Western Front. 150 divisions. They faced a slightly larger number of Russian divisions. On April the 4th, Stalin received a warning from Churchill, there you go, the asshole, in London that a German attack was planned for June 22nd. Stalin did not quite believe it, but he decided to make one last attempt to clear the air. On June the 14th, the Soviet telegraph agency TASS issued a statement in which Sir Stafford Cripps, British ambassador to Moscow, was violently attacked for circulating rumors regarding an imminent war between Russia and Germany. All rumors according to which Germany had been made territorial and economic demands on the Soviet Union, which had been rejected by the Soviet government, were denied. That Germany and Russian troops were about to commence hostilities was a fake and preposterous provocation. Actually, no demands had been made by Berlin, but it seems that Stalin was waiting for them and wanted to see them whether the task statement could break the spell of silence between Berlin and Moscow. When Schellenberg was at the Molotov's office at 9:30 p.m. on June 21st, the latter mentioned the war rumors had pointed out some regret that Germany had not taken any notice of the task statement. Why was Germany dissatisfied? What had caused this tension? The German ambassador was unable to reply to this and said he would ask Berlin. This reminds me a little bit of this deal with Donald Trump. I mean, let's face it, this guy could go off at any minute. We're surrounded by rats in this government, boys and girls, but I'm telling you, you better watch out for this Trump. He's liable to go off the rails at any time. A few hours later, he handed the Soviet Commissar for Foreign Affairs Hitler's declaration of war. The question has been raised whether Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union forestalled a Soviet attack, whether or not his was a preventive war. As proof of the Russian desire for war, statements by Soviet Russian officers and functionaries had been quoted, as well as affidavits of German generals, from which it has been inferred that the Soviet government planned or at least contemplated an offensive use of its troops stationed along the Western Front. The massing of very mobile troop units, including cavalry, on the borders gives one pause. However, their locations in the northwest and southwest of Russia conspicuously points to the probability that they were to serve as military support for Russia's political demands of November and December of 1940. If Germany were to show herself ready to renew negotiations and were to grant the Soviet Union the freedom of action it desired against Finland and in the Balkans, these units could have been used for an advance in those directions, not for an attack on Germany. As a matter of fact, the massing of Russian forces on the border was intended, in a sense, as a means of pressure. The Soviet Union wished to discourage Hitler from his aggressive intentions and to increase its own political weight. That Hitler was not to be frightened by these measures, but went over to the attack irresponsibly and boundlessly underestimated the Soviet potential on the basis of the Finnish war, came as a complete surprise to the Soviet government. A Soviet assault on Germany in summer of 1941, at a time the United States had not yet entered the war and Hitler seemed invincible, would have been lunacy. If to Stalin and Ribbentrop, Molotov Pact meant time gained, it did indeed mean that. It was not with a view to early entry into the war, but to strengthen the Soviet potential under the protection of the war between the capitalist powers. Both the pact with Germany, as well as the alliance with the Western powers from 1941 on, must not blind us to the fact that for the Bolsheviks, the war, which began in 1939, represented a long hoped-for conflict among the capitalist states, which could become the springboard for world revolution. By patiently biding his time, Stalin could expect to achieve more than by premature participation in the war. The war worked for the Soviet Union only after the Axis powers and the Western Allies had torn each other to shreds and Germany was finally vanquished, perhaps with the help of the United States. Only then, perhaps at the 11th hour, Stalin must have thought would be the moment for Russian intervention had arrived, and then only in order to share in the loot. This was Stalin's tactics in 1939 in the Polish campaign, and again in 1945 in the war against Japan. He presumably also planned to act that way in the West struggle with Hitler. Those are key statements you need to go over, think about. And you're not going to get anywhere with that type of logic with the right wing, or even the progressives as they are constituted today. But the things that cause these wars and initiate these wars are much, much more complex and deeper than the average media article leads you to believe. Like I said with the Japanese, Stalin was wanting the Western countries, the capitalist countries, to tear each other to pieces, and then he'd walk in, of which he could have, when he marched into Berlin and took Berlin. In fact, his communist buddies in the U.S. government helped him with that. They allowed him to do that. But if the total backup of the Red Army with all their materials and weapons had wanted to, they could have moved west while Germany was on its ass and the U.S. was getting tired of war. But he didn't, so that's interesting that he didn't. And the one question I often ask, among other questions I never get an answer on, is why did not, if Hitler may have been nutsy and off the rails, but when the German or Russian army was coming from the east to the west and got near Germany, why didn't he employ sarin gas? Sarin gas could have wiped out an entire Russian division or an entire Russian army. This stuff is terrible. Now, some people would say, well, he was afraid it would blow back on his own troops. Well, maybe. But faced with total annihilation and his sociopathic personality, I would think that he would have employed that in his final defense. But he didn't, which is a good question. He was paranoid, but ultimately he may not have been as quite as brutal as people think. He certainly wasn't as brutal as Stalin, and I think not nearly as brutal as Churchill or Roosevelt. These guys were all brutal. They would have done anything. They wanted to kill every German in Germany and plow up the ground. They actually had plans to do that. They wanted to drop that atomic bomb on Germany. So don't talk about other paranoid schizophrenics and sociopaths. There's plenty to go around. There always is. Now, I'm going to send you out an MP3 recording. It's a little over an hour of a interview between a New York newsman and the Peter from the Crossfire on Russia TV, Peter Menlo. Now, this covers a lot of territory because Peter Menlo has born in the United States in Massachusetts. He lived in various parts of the country, and he finally lived in California, and then he immigrated to Poland, which he loved Poland, and finally he was talked into coming on over to Russia, which he's been there for 20 years. There's some things in here in this recording you won't agree with. Of course, there's no recording that everybody agrees with, but you're going to learn a lot about the past and a lot about the present. I'll be sending it to you probably today. I'm going to finish out the show from an article here from Liberty Bell, my most favorite magazine of knowing exactly what has gone on, what is going on, and too bad it's out of existence. And my good friend and highly respected Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, the one intellectual that we've produced out of this struggle. I'm not saying there aren't other intellectuals in this struggle, but he was the greatest. Dr. Revelo P. Pendleton Oliver is rightly regarded by those few lucky enough to be familiar with his work as one of the greatest Americans of this century. Born in 1908, he quickly rose through the ranks of the Academy to become one of the leading philologists and classical scholars of his time. He gave a speech in 1968 June 9th to the German-American group assembled at the Lorelei Club in Hamburg, New York, near Buffalo on June 9th, 1968. I'm not going to be able to read all of this, and I may have read it to you before. I've got to learn to mark these after I read them. Ladies and gentlemen, let me thank you, first of all, for the honor of your invitation and the pleasure of being with you today. In the past dozen years, I've spoken before a great many conservative and patriotic organizations. This was back when that meant something. It doesn't mean shit anymore. Watching these progressive Republicans and claiming they're conservatives and how Ronald Reagan was a wonderful guy and he was somebody we should mimic is just so much scratching on the glass in my ears. I can't handle it. But this is the first time that I have appeared before a society that is specifically German, that is to say, composed of the descendants of the part of our race that stayed home in the 5th century, while their kinsfolk conquered and occupied all the western territories of the largely mongrelized and moribund Roman Empire, and their more remote kinsfolks had founded more than 1,000 years before. As I understand it, I am speaking to a closed meeting of your members and the guests of whom they have confidence. I believe that it is stipulated that what is said here today is off the record and not for publication in any form, and that there is no reporters present. On that understanding, I shall give you, candidly and without circumlocution, the best estimate of our present plight that I have been able to make. Some of you might remember the old story about the college girl who went to bed one night and finally dropped off to sleep, but in the early hours of the morning she heard a clock strike too, and she felt the door of her room was slowly opening. Terrified, she tried to call out in the darkness, but a handkerchief was whipped over her mouth and she felt strong arms lift her from the bed. She was carried downstairs, thrown into a tonneau of a large and luxurious Rolls-Royce, and set off at high speed. After a long ride, she was lifted out and carried into a large hall of a vast and palatial mansion, up marble stairs, and into an elegantly appointed room where she was thrown on the bed. Only then did she see her captor clearly. He was a strong and handsome man, attired in faultless evening dress. He stood by the bed and looked down at her speculatively and silently. She tried to speak, and at last she was able to say, whimpering, quote, "What? Oh, what are you going to do to me?" The man shrugged his shoulders, quote, "How should I know?" he said. "This is your dream." The story is absurd, of course, but it owes what little humor is possesses to the equivocal play on the mystery of their own consciousness. A dream is by definition a series of sensations that occur in the brain when both our senses of precipitation and our powers of will and reasons are in abeyance, so that we have no control over the flux of sensations. But it is, of course, a well-known phenomenon that when we dream that we are dreaming, the dream ends and we are awakened. Then the conscious mind takes over and we are again responsible for our thoughts and must face a day in which we must be responsible for our actions, which by their wisdom or folly may determine the rest of our lives. Our dreams may give expression, pleasant or painful, to our subconscious desires or fears. But in our waking hours, we must, if we are rational, make our decisions on the basis of the most objective and cold-blooded estimates that we can make, estimates of the forces and tendencies in the world about us, estimates of the realities with which we must deal, remembering always that nothing is likely to happen just because we think it's good, or unlikely to happen just because we think it's evil. If ever we have had need to appraise carefully and rationally our position and prospects, The time is now. In the outer quadrangle of the Brasenose at Oxford, if I remember correctly, there is a middle of the green sward a solitary sundial, which bronze plate bears the chilling inscription, "It is later than you think." I assure you, my fellow Americans, that it is now later, much later than you think. Now, this was in 1968. It is possible, of course, that it may now be too late, and that a veteran observer and distinguished friend of mine recently assured me our cause is now as hopeless as was the South after the fall of Richmond, and near the tragic conclusion of the Second War for Independence, which was fought on our soil. I honestly believe, however, we still have some chance of survival. That was in 68. If I did not believe that, I certainly would not be speaking to you today or asking you to consider with me the odds against us. I may be wrong. I have no powers of divination nor prophecy, and I certainly do not know the secret plans of our enemies or even the inner structure of their organization. I can only guess the probable extent of their power and of the probable efficiency of their strategy by extrapolation from what they have thus far accomplished. I can only give you my best estimate, made after long and anxious consideration, but I do not pose as an expert in these matters, and since I promised myself to be candid, I will tell you candidly that my estimates in the past proved to be overly optimistic. When I left the mephitic atmosphere of Washington late in 1945, I had no great misgivings about the future of our nation. On the basis of the best estimates that I could then make, I was confident that our future was assured by a popular reaction which I deemed inevitable within the next 5 years. I felt certain that the secrets of Washington would quickly become known and our nation would be swept with moral indignation and revulsion when Americans saw exposed to the light of day even a small part of the foul record of this diseased creature that had squatted in the White House for so many years, referring to Roosevelt. Surrounded by his appalling gang of degenerates, traitors, and alien subversives, I knew that the secret of Pearl Harbor would be quickly disclosed and that Americans would soon know that how the Japanese had been maneuvered and tricked into destroying our fleet and killing so many of our men. I was sure that the public would soon learn that the old conspiracy between the Roosevelt and Churchill, who was at the time a private citizen in what was called Great Britain, and also of Roosevelt's persistent efforts from 1936 to 39 to get started in Europe the insanely fratricidal war that devastated the continent and destroyed so much of what is the most precious and irreplaceable treasure of any race, the genetic heritage of its men, best men, and that inflicted upon our own country a great squandering of life and wealth in war that was deliberately conducted to be assure the defeat of the United States and Great Britain no less than that of France and Germany. I was sure that we would quickly, once peace had come, see that we had fought for the sole purpose of imposing the beasts of Bolshevism on a devastated land. I was sure that we would quickly see the nature of the great treason trap called the United Nations. I thought that decent men's stomach would turn when they learned about the officially admitted strategy of the British government, which in deliberate violation of all conventions of civilized warfare had initiated the vicious bombing of unprotected German cities for the express purpose of slaughtering so many defenseless German civilians, that the German government would be forced to bomb unprotected British cities and slaughter enough helpless British citizens to work up in Great Britain some enthusiasm for the suicidal war that the British government was imposing on its reluctant people. One thing you might want to remember not to be a Russian phobe, but it wasn't Russians bombing Germany. I don't think there's any evidence that the Russian bombers came over Germany and bombed the population. It was only American, German, and maybe some French. The first example in history, I believe, of a government at war deliberately having its own citizens massacred for the purpose of propaganda. I thought that the truth about such domestic outrages as in the infamous sedition trial in Washington would necessarily become known and excite the feelings, and such crimes must excite the beast breasts of decent men. And I was sure that a thousand other infamies, unsurpassed and only rarely equaled in recorded history, would be disclosed, with the result that all the steamships outward bound from our shores would, within a few years, be crowded to their rails with hordes of vermin desperately fleeing from the wrath of the aroused and angry nation. In 1945, I really believe that by the year 1952, no American could hear the name Roosevelt without a shudder, or an uttering it without a curse. You see, I was wrong. I was right about the inevitability of exposure, like the bodies of the Polish officers who were butchered in the Katyn Forest by the Bolsheviks, as we knew at the time. Many of the Roosevelt regime's secret crimes were exposed to the light of day. The exposures were neither so rapid or so complete as I anticipated, but their aggregate is far more than should have been needed for the anticipated reaction. Only about 80% of the secrets of Pearl Harbor has thus far become known. But that 80% should be itself be enough to nauseate a healthy man. Of course, I do not believe, I do not know, and I may not even suspect the full extent of the treason of that incredible administration, but I should guess that at least half of it has been disclosed in print somewhere, not necessarily in well-known sources, but in books and articles in various languages, including publications that the international conspiracy tries to keep from the public, and not necessarily in the form of direct testimony, but at least in the form of evidence from which any thinking man can draw the proper and inescapable deductions. The information is fairly widely known, especially the Pearl Harbor story, to suggest to anyone seriously interested in the preservation of his country that he should learn more, but the reaction never occurred. And even today, the commonly used 6-cent postage stamp bears the bloated and sneering visage of the great war criminal, and one hears little protest from the public. Just think of this: they maneuvered Japan into the war, and then after this terrible war with Japan, comes back and drops atomic bombs on them, of which they wanted to drop on Germany, but that war was over before they could get the bomb ready. This is the kind of government we've had for a long time, boys and girls. It's been a criminal, warmongering government for a long time. We don't have to go anywhere to find an enemy. They're right here, and they're in the seats of power, period. It is true that there were some faint and feeble beginnings of reaction, especially when Senator Joseph McCarthy began his famous series of hearings before the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security. You hear people always using Senator McCarthy's name in vain. It's become a standard thing. Be careful when you run into that kind of a problem, because he was right. Washington was full of communists. We were allies of the Soviet Union during the war, with communists running all over this country. They were our allies. And even with Harry Dexter White and all these people, they were in the White House. They were living in the White House, some of them. And after the Soviet Union fell, they went into the KGB archives, the Russian archives, and found out the evidence that McCarthy was right. Washington was full of communists. However, before the war, I would have been one that would take the position that I'm not worried about the communists taking over the United States, at least lower-level communists. I would not have banned them because I believe too much in free speech, and I don't think they had a chance in hell of taking over in this country. But the fact that we go to war and get involved with all this bullshit and in league with the Soviet Union and the communists opens the door even more for them. Every time we say we're going to do something to stop something, we make it worse. But I was wrong again. Instead, a friend of mine was right. He was at the time a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, which at that time included some Americans. And he happened to be in Wheeling, West Virginia on the 9th of February, 1950, when Senator McCarthy made his famous speech in which he stated that there were 57 members of the Communist Party or of the Soviet espionage apparatus in the State Department in positions of responsibility, and that the State Department knew that they were there. Well, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. You'd think Russia wouldn't be trying to get into the government? All governments try to infiltrate other governments, no matter what they are, no matter whether you agree with them or not. But they don't have to call them communists anymore. Now they're progressives. They've imported the worst parts of the communist ideology. Read the Constitution of the Soviet Union. It's the same shit that Obama and all these Republicans, too, are promoting. It's ridiculous. After the speech, my friend found an opportunity to talk to McCarthy alone. He told him, "Senator, you said there were 57 known communists in the State Department. If you had access to the files of my agency, you would know that there is absolute proof that there are 10 times that many. But, Senator, you do not realize the magnitude of the power of the conspiracy you are attacking. They will destroy you, and they will destroy you utterly." That's the end of my reading for today. I'm going to continue this article tomorrow. It's a long article. And I hope I didn't read it to you before. I don't think I did. But if I did, you need it. You need to think about it, read about it all the time. And know that you're in an occupied nation. You do not live in a democracy. You do not live in a republic. You live in an oligarchy of the worst kind of people. And they're all in power. And they're dragging up all the non-whites behind them to work with them, because it's easy for them to get most of the blacks to work with them. You see more and more. Even on TV, every ad now has got lots of blacks all over the place. And they love to have black men and white women, too. It's moving so fast, it's unbelievable. Well, maybe that's makes what I say better. Worse is better, and if it starts to collapse into erode and come down around. I think we can't have anything any worse. It'll get worse physically, but in the end it can be better. Just think about that. You can't treat cancer with band-aids. It's never been accomplished in history. If you're gonna get rid of cancer, you gotta cut it out. Got to cut deep and cut seriously, even at the possibility of losing the patient. See you tomorrow.
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over. until we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie? Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit.